Coming up on this In Contrast special, the sixth of seven episodes examining American media. I'm Ilan Stavans.
And I'm Ray Suarez.
In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio and Quixote Productions. In this episode, I'd like to concentrate on what we are missing in the current landscape of American media. And maybe indirectly or at the center of it is the very topic of censorship. Not that it is a deliberate approach to forbidding certain stories, but because of the metabolism of the media itself, there are aspects that are left out. So here is an anecdote. Ray, when I first arrived in this country, the United States, from Mexico in the mid-80s, I remember going to grocery stores and being flabbergasted by the amount of cereals being offered on a particular aisle of the supermarket. Compared to what I had in my native country, the amount was extraordinary and extraordinarily exciting. There would be all sorts of flavors, all sorts of figures on the boxes that I could admire or try to understand who this basketball player or this Olympic star were, the particular cartoon characters. And the initial reaction was of plentifulness, so to speak. Everything was available and I could reach it as long as I had some money to be able to afford it. Over time, of course, I settled on two or one, and I would find myself going to the very same aisle and not even looking at the many possibilities, but concentrating on what was by then a mechanical act. It seems to me that the amount that we are exposed to in American media, because of the plethora of possibilities, the zillion channels, the many stations, the different takes, is on the one hand overwhelming in its richness. On the other hand, it might be a way of paralyzing the listener, the viewer, in not knowing what to choose or how to exercise the very effort of choosing.
Well, I'm glad you're using cereal as a metaphor, because I think it's an apt metaphor and one that we can put in harness and get some more use out of. Imagine for a moment, and of course, the cereal aisle has grown nothing but more crowded in the intervening 30 or so years that we're talking about, with many more brands and many more types and many more variations on the original set of cereals. Imagine if you could keep making new brands with no restraint. It was bounty with no natural limit to the bounty. Nobody around the table at General Mills or Post is saying, yeah, I think we have enough brands of cereal. I think we ought to stop. But instead, they're saying, no, no, let's make more brands. And eventually, the entire supermarket is just aisles of different cereals. That's kind of where we're at now. And part of the problem is there's not a great deal of difference between some of these various kinds of cereals. There are half a dozen different kinds of oat-based cereals. There are a dozen different kinds of rough, grainy wheat cereals. Each company has to come out with its own version of the other company's cereals that it calls something slightly different. It's like a natural landscape where there are only animals, but all animals who have no predators, because there's nothing keeping down the population. Right now, because the business model of the American communications business is in such distress, we just keep spinning off new products, hoping that something catches on, hoping that the box or the shiny logo or something catches the shopper's eye as he or she is wandering through the endless aisles of variety, of possibility, of slight tweaking or variation in tone, in presentation, in content. And because we've got that surfeit, because we've got that tremendous oversupply, because we've got the tremendous oversupply of people who are willing to make content, and no natural predators, no market forces that are keeping down the number of competitors, it is a bewildering set of aisles that presents itself to the media shopper who's going up and down the aisles with his little cart or her little cart. Podcasts and television shows and television series that launch from what used to be retail websites. So Amazon has its own television shows. Netflix, that used to be an aggregator of content made by other people, in fact, makes its own purpose-made content now that's just for Netflix and not seen anywhere else, not seen in the movies, not seen on DVD. It is an amazing, kind of wonderful, because it's also happened at the same time as a golden age of product. There's some wonderful things being made out there, but it hasn't done the news business very much good.
Of course, what you're talking about is the tyranny of the new. Every time there is new product, we believe that because of its newness, it has to have more of an attractive side to it than anything that stays. There's the competition of what is considered a classic or what is considered the oldies, that there will be particular channels on television more than in other media that will be repeating, syndicating these items. But the new pushes people forward because this is the country, this is a nation, and this is a civilization that believes that youth is what matters. And as long as you're youthful, then you are still part of a larger vision here. One of the things that arises in my mind as we're talking about this is if the market, the media market, the surplus of products that are out there, because consumers are infatuated, even hypnotized and numbed by that multiplicity, if the market at any point will level itself, if we are witnessing, as you are putting it, this period of bonanza of possibilities, particularly on television, where it seems that the movies and theater are second thoughts to even literature, to what Netflix or an Amazon series or a Hulu series can do in not only enthralling a narrative, but in keeping people hooked for hours on end to the television. Is there a moment in which the population will say this is enough, or the market itself will say it is saturated, we can't go any further? And I have another side of this that I want us to discuss, and that is the question of censorship that I mentioned it before. When we talk about censorship, we talk about the prohibition or the act of forbidding something from arriving to the public, most often the public eye or ear, generally having a political or ideological force behind it that is making that particular item dangerous or hot or acquiring certain elements that could potentially have some ripple effects. But there is the aspect of censorship in a dictatorship. I'm thinking here of Stalin or Hitler or Tito or Fidel Castro or Hugo Chavez. That is, certain items that are kept out of the media because this is an ideology that will exclude that which is unpleasant or unwelcome to it. But there is also another type of censorship, and that censorship is the one that results from an overabundance, where in the end you have so much that you no longer are able to discriminate between one thing or another. And I remember a famous line by Ray Bradbury, the author of The Martian Chronicles and other books, where he said it's one thing is to forbid a book from being read, and the other one is for people not to read the book altogether. What's worse, the apathy that comes from not reading or the fact that a book will be forbidden because it is dangerous? Those are different approaches. One last thought, and that is that Borges once said that censorship is the mother of metaphor, meaning that because there is something forbidden, you look for alternative ways to engage with that which cannot be said in flowery or clearly metaphorical ways.
I think you're onto something when you suggest that we are toying as a society with not banning things or preventing things from being heard, but supplying so much to be seen and heard and understood that it's impossible to keep track of it all. So oversupply breeds bewilderment, really. And while everything is out there, it's impossible for everything to be known. So no one is keeping the nation or in these times to left-of-center journals of opinion and reporting. No one's preventing them from publishing. No one's preventing them from distributing. There are certainly powers and interests in the United States that would rather have a country with no nation and no in these times and no Mother Jones. But they know that they don't have to use the blunt instrument of throwing rocks through their storefront window on a main commercial street or destroying their presses or beating up their reporters. We don't have to do that in the United States. Just let them publish. We'll just ignore them, which is a disturbing, frightening, and should be a concerning prospect for Americans, whatever their ideological temperature is. The way that we have constructed a for-profit model that throws up so much content. There are now scores of thousands of podcasts, and you and I are sitting across a table from each other right now, adding in this very moment to the oversupply and making sure that the eventual audience for all podcasts is subdivided by that little fraction more. So yes, it's sort of benign de facto censorship, knowing that by just studiously ignoring inconvenient messages and exalting other messages, we don't have to do anything as rough and blunt as shutting places down or arresting their reporters. We'll just make sure that people don't pay attention to them.
This touches on the question, of course, of the First Amendment in what can be said or cannot be said, and in some ways turns it upside down. It's not that we cannot say things, it's that we can say everything, and because we can say everything, nothing unique is put out there that matters. It seems to me that there's a fat in the amount of information, maybe in the amount of trivial information that we're putting out there, or maybe in just the mishmash, a Hebrew word that means chaos, in which we are no longer able to discriminate between what information matters and what information doesn't matter. So the question is, what is it that we are not seeing on television? What is it that we are not hearing on radio when we hear only about Donald Trump, when we hear only about a particular eruption of a volcano or a violent outburst in a high school or a terrorist attack? We could say without a doubt that American media is right there where the action is taking place. But where are we not?
I fought these battles for decades as a reporter around the table at a morning editorial meeting, as we basically ruled certain stories in and ruled certain stories out, sometimes stories of great importance to the marketplace that we were addressing with our product, that took second place or third place or fifth place to stories that would engage, amuse, draw people in, that were, frankly, trivial. So the purists, and I've long since repented from being a purist, but the purists sat around the table and said, of course, we have to do this because responsible news people do this. And there was an idea of the folk ways of the business that would drive you toward telling people what they needed to know, what they should know, what they ought to know to do the work of being a citizen. But there were also around the table people who were engaged in the business side of the business as much as the teaching side of the business and knew that there was a body of knowledge that people wanted to know, would be entertained by, would be engaged by, and so they argued for that. One night I was at a hot, I mean hot, public hearing on the siting of a high-temperature incinerator for medical waste in a very poor township in the Chicago metropolitan area. Now, of course, smoke that comes out of a smokestack drifts where it may, from poor townships to rich ones, from the township that approves the smokestack to the ones that never approved, but the air just continues to drift over them. And so this engaged people from a wide range of communities. The working class neighborhood that was about to permit the high temperature medical waste incinerator needed revenue to stay in business. But people from far away, Winnetka and Wilmette and Lake Forest, some of the richest zip codes in the United States, were there losing their minds because it was early in the days of the HIV epidemic. We didn't know exactly what it would mean to burn blood samples, burn the medical implements used to treat AIDS patients. And even though there was expert testimony at the hearing saying, oh, look, we burn this stuff at such a high temperature, it just doesn't matter. You're not going to be infected with anything. People were incensed. I called my editor. I said, oh, this is a great story. This is really, it pits communities of wealth versus communities of poverty. They can't tax their local homeowners anymore. So they're doing this thing. You know, this company's coming in from another part of the country and saying, here, we'll give you this thing and we'll give you this money to put it in. And here's our studies and here's our scientists. No problem. Don't worry. And the whole metropolitan area becomes engaged because air is promiscuous that way. It just goes places. And my story got dropped down in the order and then got dropped down from a full story to just a little bit of video and an anchor read because we got video from an interview between Roseanne Barr and David Letterman on that night's Letterman show, which is, of course, taped earlier in the day. And I screamed at the producer. This is the worst kind of trivialization people have on the evening news, a half an hour to find out everything that happened in the world that day that should shape their understanding of what's important about the world. Here's a story that was happening just a few miles away, and instead we were using an entertainment interview between a star who wasn't even on our network and our late night talk show host as a way of using the news as a vehicle for promotion for an entertainment program. So this good story wasn't being told in favor of this other story. How righteous, how idealistic, how naive I was. You know, it went ahead and that happened and we had a drag out fight on the floor of the newsroom when I got back from shooting this story. But in the years since, I've lost other battles like that, and I know that it's a mix, a set of interests come to the table when you're making these decisions, and they are not always motivated by the prime interest of informing the public. When Entertainment Tonight went on the air, it made itself look like a newscast. Access Hollywood looks like a newscast. They take on the visual language, the symbolic language, a box over the anchor's shoulder while he or she is reading a piece of entertainment news. It's meant to elevate gossip from Hollywood and the news of the release of a new movie to the same level as fighting in the Middle East, famine in Africa, a crisis with a currency in Southeast Asia that affects the price of something we buy in our stores. It is tough to balance all those interests. And the news business, because it's so insecure about its business model, has to go with what's going to sell. And then maybe if we have some time afterward, we can have this higher-toned conversation about what matters and what's important and what our viewers, listeners, readers should know.
One can argue, of course, that we are not only living in the golden age of narrative, but we're living in the golden age of media in the democratic sense, in the pluralistic sense, that every single idea can be heard. So I'm kind of taking the devil's side here. We have a surplus of ideas, but at least we have all the ideas in front of us. There are very many fringe views that if they don't make it to the NewsHour or to ABC News and Primetime or any other network, they are available in a podcast or they are available in a YouTube channel and people can get it. But we have been talking, of course, about the fragmentation of viewership as a result of that. One of the questions that I often return to is the emergence of sports as another aspect of the news media that ends up making us less and less cosmopolitan and connected with the rest of the world and more insular and only attached to our own team or our own icon or basketball star. When you were saying about Letterman and Roseanne Barr, this is a story that ends up being really very much about people that already are tuned into the media in the United States. Somebody who lives in Africa will not know what that piece of news is about because that show is not available there. The media creates a kind of cocoon where you are inside. Whatever is outside, whatever connects us with other parts of the world, is less marketable, offers less attraction and entertainment, as you were saying. And that happens with the emergence of channel after channel and news piece that are connected with sports, to me.
But at the same time, Ilan, and here's what's really fascinating about this. At the same time as it's creating parochialism, as it's reinforcing smallness, as you pull in the boundaries of your community around you, and I care about this team, it's creating cosmopolitanism at the very same moment. Here, where we're talking in a studio in Massachusetts, there are bars where when there is a key game in the English Premier League or the Spanish top professional league, that bar will fill up with partisans of Barca or Madrid or Juventus, AC Milan or Manchester United, and you will be able to consume sports in a way that you never were able to in the history of the world. You had to wait till the next day's newspaper to open up and look for the tiny type, the back of the sports section, to find out whether Everton beat Sheffield. We are, in keeping with that metaphor of the cereal aisle, able to satisfy every taste, even the tiniest minority taste. As so often happens in this conversation about this surplus supply, this incredible, endless supply of inventory, we are creating cosmopolitanism and creating parochialism in the very same moment, with no sense of contradiction, no sense of cross purposes. It's just that there's so much stuff that we can satisfy every appetite and satisfy every desire.
I'm fascinated by the viewership and the listenership that sports have, and that tension between the rural and the cosmopolitan that come together. Also by the tribalism that results from the passion for these particular teams, which are not about the Boston area players, but really the players come from all over and end up representing Boston or the Yankees or the Cavaliers or the Angels or whoever it is. There is something that sports does that it follows precisely the line of argument that you and I have seems to me been developing, which is, let me give you entertainment. Let me give you forgetfulness. Let me give you a drug that will make you forget the immediate reality that you are living in for 2 hours or 3 hours, and do so with the adrenaline running. And we are going to be a happy channel because we're going to get all these viewers that are going to result in more advertising. You are going to be excited because you will forget the routine that you exist in. And what is left out is the rest of the world. So what is left out is that manufacturing of the reduction of our attention into this particular story. Maybe I'm sounding like an anti-sports person here. And on occasion, I have to say, I find watching a Law & Order episode or a baseball game incredibly relaxing, intellectually relaxing, after an intense day of writing or of teaching. But I also think that watching them 7 days a week at the expense of the many other stories that are out there is incredibly distressing.
Well, I think this is the moment where a lot of our listeners are going to say, oh, goodness, what a cynic. Because in the world of news, when in some form a sportsman, sportswoman, or a team does something that helps connect sports to the normal news diet, they have a little orgasm. They go crazy. This is great because now we don't even have to talk about the news. We can talk about sports even more. Thank you, Colin Kaepernick, for kneeling on the sideline, because now we can elevate football from just a game to something that impinges on the actual culture wars going on around patriotism and the flag and what it means to kneel during the Star Spangled Banner. It may sound harsh, but thank you, domestic abuser, professional sports players, because now we get to gravely talk about the problem, the real problem of domestic abuse, but also bring in sports, which gives it a little extra edge, a little extra electric current, and gives us an excuse to talk about sports even more. Goodness gracious. It is one of the worst tendencies of the conventional news business to look for ways not to relate real life to sports, but to relate sports to quote-unquote, real life. So you don't even have to wait until it's time to give the scores for the jocular guy on the set to say, oh boy, it was a bad night for the Yankees. But instead, you can put it up higher in the newscast and talk about steroids. You can talk about homophobia. You can talk about bullying. You can talk about traumatic brain injury. The best of all possible worlds is when you can relate a serious news story to something that has to do with sports.
In most of the games have to do with malehood, with a kind of heroism. And there is always a backlash to what you just said. So we have a little discussion on racism or homophobia or brain injuries. But then you hear immediately, this is sports. We shouldn't be talking about medicine. We shouldn't be talking about politics. We shouldn't be wondering if he is going to kneel down or not. We should be focusing on who wins, which is the best team. And there again, we create artificial separations between the topics that we have that genuinely concern us and the topics that we artificially create in order to escape. The other side of this story would be that maybe thinking too much about all these topics as a society would be dangerous for the society. We're going back to the opium of the masses, that keeping people in their place, happy and satisfied, is far better for the ruling class, for those in control, for those putting the money in, than making people think, that maybe people wonder, that making people skeptical. What you don't want in the media is to make people skeptical. Why? Because they can tune off. And if they tune off, you have lost your channel of communication.
Well, there has to be, I'm sure there is, I live in hope that there is, a way to steer between the rocks of this Scylla and Charybdis, if I'm pronouncing those famous, terrible, mythical Greek islands that Odysseus had to find his way through. You can end up not going on the rocks. You have to be smart. You have to understand who your audience is. You have to have a sense of mission that's defined by both the public good and the ability to keep coming back next week and tomorrow and the week after that and next month, so that you still have a business model. Why don't we pick it up there, basically with the question, okay, well, what do we do now?
Let us know what you think about this In Contrast special. Review us on Apple Podcasts or send an email to radio@nepr.net. You can also follow us on Facebook, where we invite you to share your comments on this program and others in our series. To find out more about all of our In Contrast programs, visit our website at nepr.net/In Contrast. Our music is by the Fresh Cut Orchestra. The executive producer of In Contrast is John Vosey. I'm Milan Stavans.
And I'm Ray Suarez. Thank you for listening.
In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio and Quixote Productions.